Hello everyone, this is Mike Quinsey connecting the light. My guest today is Sheila Applegate. She is a spiritual seer, healer and teacher of oneness, a clinical therapist and author. And we're going to discuss her book called Enchanted One, which she describes as a portal to love. So welcome to the program, Sheila.
Thank you. Hello, it's wonderful to be here.
Great. Now, I noticed in some of the information you supplied me about the book that it was going to be released literally about a week ago. Did that come about?
It absolutely did. It was released on December 28th.
Fine, okay. So we're talking about something that's available now and not something
absolutely.
That will be. That's
yep.
Great. Okay. Did you have a nice Christmas, by the way?
I had a wonderful Christmas. How about you?
Oh, yes, very quiet. Tends to be that way, I think, when you get a bit older and your family's grown up and sort of left the nest. But I see, looking at your photograph, you're obviously still a young lady.
Fairly young. we'll go with that.
Yeah, I bet you will, yes. It's how you feel and how you sound, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And you sound a young person. And may we sort of get into the subject a little bit by saying it's also how you lead your life, isn't it? And what your expectations are and what you're trying to do.
I would say absolutely. I think that, you know, working with spirit is like the fountain of youth.
Yes, I agree with you there. Now, I'm always curious as to how people start their particular thing in life, and I'm sure my listeners are. So how long ago was it when you suddenly discovered that you could contact beings such as Isis and Magdalene, who you are in contact with now?
Well, I would say that it wasn't a sudden discovery as far as it being some enlightened moment, although Magdalene did appear to me in one very particular strong moment that I can talk to you about. But I actually began as a clinical social worker, a child and family therapist, and one of my supervisors introduced me to a metaphysical Christian church, and we learned guided meditation, and I learned how to go in through guided meditation and to start to connect with angels and ascended master teachers. And then from there, I opened up to do that for other people and more just sort of opened to the path. And it was a couple years later that I was going through a relatively difficult time and I was not in a meditation. So this is where I say that was a sudden moment. And I was lying on my couch and an image of Magdalene appeared to me and she began to talk to me and say that she introduced herself to me as Jesus's beloved and began to tell me that she would walk very closely with me. So I got to know her personally and then moved into doing this for others.
Right. It sounds as though you accepted this situation which came upon you without any problems or without any difficulty. Did it seem quite a natural thing to you?
It did. You know, I mean, I was prepared. I was already at that point communicating with spirit, but usually with my eyes closed and when I intended to. So it definitely made me notice. Although when I look back into my earlier days, it wasn't the first time I had had I had actually been in England with the students for the Pan Am Lockerbie incident. And when I came home from that, one of my friends who had crossed over did appear to me. So I guess it wasn't the first time, but having Magdalene be there was a little bit of a big deal.
Right. So now how long ago did you then first have this contact with Magdalene?
I would say that it was probably about 11 years ago, 10 or 11 years
ago.
Oh, right.
So that's quite a long time. Now, during that period of time then, did you contact her regularly or vice versa? And what's the purpose of that for your personal enlightenment, or did you sort of put information out?
I was already starting to do that as far as teaching meditation and giving readings at that point. So even though I was working very closely with her and in my own personal journey of opening to unconditional love and learning to integrate spirit into my life, I was always turning it around and sharing that with others.
Right. Now, as an ordained minister, did that actually help you with the work that you're doing now?
Well, I am ordained through the church that I mentioned earlier, and so it is a metaphysical church. So a lot of the preparation for my ordination was in being able to do healing and prophecy. So that definitely has helped me.
Right. So just to ask you again on one point here, then did you actually spread a lot of the information out, or was that, say, confined to workshops as you did or personal readings and that sort of thing?
It's been spreading out for over the years. I have worked in Glastonbury, England a few times, and I have done several radio shows. I did have a radio show called Enchanted One for a few years where I also shared the information there, and I have been doing some traveling as well as some online classes over the years.
Right. So do you feel... Sorry, yes?
I've been getting it out there, I guess. Or trying.
Well, I wondered about the background to it all, because I've been involved in sort of spirit work for quite a long time, and I can't knowingly say that I've seen any messages going around that have your name to them. So I just wondered if that was because, in general terms, it didn't sort of work like that for you. So it was interesting to know how you sort of set yourself up.
Yes, I think that the putting the book out has increased the exposure as well. I've never advertised, everything is spread through word of mouth and just people wanting to hear the messages.
Right. You mentioned Lockerbie, of course, which in Great Britain was quite a tragedy. Did you mention that in connection with someone coming to you and trying to contact their departed or trying to get some information on what really happened?
No, it was actually, I was one of the Syracuse University students in England at the time, and I had stayed over for Christmas with some friends, so I wasn't on the plane, but all of the other students that I was with, or the majority of the other students, were on that plane.
Oh, dear.
And when I returned, I went to one of the families for a memorial service, and the family, of course, did not know what the last few months of their daughter's life was about, like, so they had asked me a lot of questions that night, and I stayed in their home, and I slept in her room, and she appeared to me on the bed just for a short second. I think I was frightened and also okay because it was a friend, and all she did was ask. So that was probably the first time I was asked to relay a message to someone, because she asked me to tell her family she was okay. The next morning, I was a little frightened to do it because I hadn't really started any of the meditation in that at that point, but I did pass that on. So that definitely planted the seed for me. I'm sure that it was something that I could do.
Right. Now, where you're mentioning meditation here, is that something you recommend to people to get them in a calm and peaceful state of mind to make contact with beings in spirit?
Yes. Well, I think, you know, people can go into this in whatever way feels correct for them, but that has been the key to me. And it's guided meditation. So when I teach people, I lead them on a meditation and I'm guiding them, but then it begins to come alive for them and they see the things, but then they'll be able to move over after without my guidance and be able to make that connection on their own.
Fine. Now, what did I want to say? Yes, you had Magdalene appear to you. Do you happen to know whether you've had sort of connection with Magdalene before? Because I'm assuming, in light of what you're doing, that you believe in incarnation. And I think a lot of people that are working with spirit have often had contact with their principal contact in lives before. Does that apply to you?
I have a very strong connection to Magdalene, but I do not believe that I was alive at the time of her life. It feels to me, when I look in, it feels to me like I was aware and present, but more in spirit form. So I do not have, although people who are very close to me do have memories of being with her and around her. And I actually now have some of her memories just because of working so closely with her, but I'm very clear that they're not my own.
Right. Now, you talk, where your book is concerned, about sort of joining and linking together the messages from these two goddesses, the second one being Isis. I mean, do you have any known contact with Egypt or Isis in your past?
Yeah, that is my stronger connection, although I would not have known that growing up in the Protestant home that I grew up in. But it was actually Magdalene that introduced. I didn't really feel connected to Isis until Magdalene introduced me to her. And Magdalene described her as being one of her spirit guides during the time of her life. Mm. And through that connection, I felt a very strong affinity to Egypt and to Isis as well.
Yes. You very much mirror in that sense what I feel also, because I was given a lifetime in Egypt, pre-pharaonic times, when I was a high priest and told that it was a very satisfactory life that I enjoyed, etc., etc. And the first time I went to Egypt, that was a long time ago now, I did feel an affinity with Egypt, and it became so strong that when I started my own spiritual quest, one of the first things I did was to find out as much of the very ancient history of Egypt as I could. And somehow I think that was like my footstool to learning a lot more. So I have a sort of fond link with Egypt.
Oh, that's beautiful. I would love to hear someday some of the things you learned.
Well, who knows? I guess they're relevant now. Okay. I'm looking down my little list of notes here, although you've given me some information. Okay, I think we better get round to some of your philosophies or some of the things you have in your book. Incidentally, what inspired you to write the book in the first place?
I feel like I feel like it was Magdalene and Isis that were pushing me all along. I think I resisted it quite a bit in the earlier years. It actually took me 10 years. I was writing it all those years that I was working. And some of the channels were actually there's channeled messages in the book, and some of them are actually transcribed from ones that I did live through my voice. So the real inspiration is to get the message of divine love out into the world and to help people to understand the importance of embracing our emotions as a way of bringing spirituality into our daily life and to open up that heart center. I believe that we're in a time where the heart and the goddess energy, not meaning male versus female, but that divine feminine, the goddess heart-centered energy, is so crucial. And I think the timing of the book coming out is perfect right now, because the world's ready for that.
Yes, I agree with you there. Are you also thinking of the timing in the sense that we've just gone through that important date, the 21st of December, and of course a lot of us, including myself, believe that there was a very high input of energy that's lifted us up, possibly expanded our level of consciousness. So did that have any bearing on the date?
I really believe it did. I believe it did because, you know, I had to, I surrendered the whole time. I follow spirit and their guidance in everything I do. Of course, I take action or I wouldn't be able to get the message to the world, but it's always in direct communication. And so this book was completed a couple years ago and I was following a winding path. And in fact, Magdalene woke me up in the middle of the night a few years ago and told me even what publishing company would be taking me, but it took him a couple years to get around to it. But yeah. I don't even think it was because of them. I think it was because of the timing. And what happened is the books that I ordered for my live events arrived to me on December 21st. So I had to smile at that point and say, you know, it couldn't have been any other day.
Oh, that was significant, wasn't it? Now, I believe, and I know you do, that in this coming period of time when we're entering a new age, it is in fact important that we start to work towards a condition where we can express ourselves unconditionally where love is concerned. Now, it would seem to me that that's one of the main themes in your book. Would that be correct?
Absolutely. I think that that really is the strongest message. And it's about first learning to unconditionally love yourself, because the only way to love others at that level is to work at loving ourselves and to open up to that space and realize that every part of ourself is beautiful. And then to be able to do that with others. And I think that our world does not even realize how conditional love is. It's so programmed to us to be conditional that until we open our eyes and really start to examine it, we don't realize how often our love is tied to expectations.
Absolutely. And I must say, when I read of these awful incidents in the press where a person has murdered another one because they feel that they have let them down and left them and gone to someone else, and the attitude is, if I can't have you, no one else will, I think what a terrible way of viewing someone else in life, virtually, that you feel you own them. And we've got to learn, I think, to let people go. And perhaps when we reach this level of unconditional love without any judgment, we can do it.
Yes, because then we start to separate the form of relationships from the flow of love. And I think in our world, we confuse those two very much right now.
Yes, I think you're correct there. So how does your vision of, I believe, what you've described as sacred love, rebuild our world so that we can enter this new age?
Well, I believe the first step to the sacred love is our reconnecting to our own higher power, our own connection to oneness, God, divine source, whatever it is we describe. And until we take the time to do that, to look at ourselves, to examine ourselves, to take responsibility for ourselves and define that inner peace that comes from that union, then the world is built by each individual moving into that space. So we can't look at the world outside of us and say, you know, it's got to change without first aligning ourselves exactly the way we think the world should be. So we take the first step of going inward and accepting and taking responsibility and finding that joy and that peace inside of ourselves. And I guide, you know, that's easier said than done. And there's been a lot of philosophy about it. And now is the time to feel it and to do it and to actually experience that in our lives. And then from that space, when you really believe and start to remember that everyone is a reflection of God or the divine, you start to behave differently. And the need for competition and separation and pain is no longer there.
Yes, yes, indeed. And I would guess also one would emphasize the oneness of everything and the way we're all connected. You can't just ignore or treat someone else differently, or you shouldn't, because what you do to one, in that sense, you do to all.
Yes, and I think, you know, the scientists have been wonderful at helping us to understand that conceptually. And then, as you said, now we're in 2013, there's a shift of energy here. Now the energy is supporting us and experiencing that and actually feeling and embodying it. And that's a very different thing than just thinking it.
Yes. Now, you speak of embracing the full spectrum of emotions. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that a lot of people, the whole world probably, and especially people who are seeking to be on the spiritual path, have this misconception that there are good emotions and bad emotions, and that a true spiritual person will only experience the ones in the spectrum of peace and love and joy. But we are human beings, and we will experience the full spectrum of emotion, which includes jealousy, anger, fear. And to deny that we feel it doesn't make it go away. It just suppresses it and makes it come out in a different way. And what people maybe perceived as peace, it was really just numbness. So I think sometimes we've heard people that were on, sort of on the outside looking in going, well, I don't want to do the spiritual path because, I don't want it. They seem too peaceful all the time or too vacant. And I think that that is something that's happened. And so to really be alive in spirit is not to be vacant. It's to be both peaceful and passionate. And in order to do that, we have to acknowledge that we have the full spectrum of emotion and get comfortable with them so that we can use them in a mastered and beautiful way and transform them to support us rather than suppress us.
Right. So a lot of people have problems at this time because of the type of world we're in with fear of injury, death, war, things of that nature. It's a big stumbling block and an obstacle, I believe, to being able to express yourself and reach that goal of unconditional love. How would you deal with people that have a lot of fear for different reasons? I mean, how do they overcome it?
Well, I think that our real core fear is that we are separate from God or the divine. Because if we're fearing, there's such a conflict in so many of the religions that say, when you get to heaven, you'll be rewarded and it'll be so beautiful, but try not to die. And if somebody dies, that's a tragedy. And God, so how do we deal with this internal embedded conflict of there's something beautiful beyond this place in the oneness, and I'm afraid to go there, because that's our instinctual thing, stay alive. And when we realize that we can bring that beauty, we don't have to wait until death to experience the vibration of heaven. We begin to bring that into our life on a daily basis. To me, it's through meditation. To others, it may be through music or art. But when we sit in that space, then it helps to transform us. And then when we're afraid, we can hold that space there. We stay connected to spirit even in those more difficult emotions. And then we're able to face them. And in that space of divine love, as we're facing those emotions, we realize that they were just illusions and they begin to melt away. But we have to get ourselves to a space where it's safe enough to actually experience the fear. Because a lot of these emotions we're actually just pushing and pulling at so much that we don't even actually experience them. And that's actually a worse feeling than going into the fear.
Yes, I'm sure you're right on that particular one. Now, in your book, you talk a lot about the divine feminine. Can you explain what that is? And would you think that men who are brought up right from birth to be masculine, a man doesn't cry and all this type of business, would they be able to accept the divine feminine as easily as perhaps females would? I mean, what are your views on that?
Well, I do believe the divine feminine is in all of us, like you are mentioning, and it isn't about the female or the male. I think our society has created a little bit more space for the female to experience that heart-centered, although we have to say that they're put down a lot for being too emotional or dramatic, or we do it to both sides. But right. I think that people are conditioned not to feel, and probably both sexes in their own way are conditioned in that way, and that will make it difficult, more difficult. But I think the world is changing now and opening to that. And you see it in things, even just like the television shows are shifting in their language and in their topic. So I believe that everyone can absolutely open to that and that it is our natural state. One of the things I noticed even just in this first week of the book being released is that a lot of men are responding to it, where, as you had kind of indicated, most of my work over the years has been primarily with women. I noticed a shift, and I don't know if that was the shift of 2013 or if it's the shift I'm seeing because of the book, but there is definitely something happening that the men are opening up very rapidly right now.
I think that's true. I can remember, because I'm quite old in the tooth, when I was younger, that a man's role was very clearly defined. And for example, where babies came into the family, it was always looked upon as 100% the mother's responsibility and duty to look after the baby and do things. But I mean, these days they'll change nappies, they'll push the pram. I think the approach to doing what they think is purely a woman's work, which is feminine, has changed tremendously. And does this show that in fact we are becoming more balanced?
Absolutely. And don't you think that that in itself helps to balance the men? Because what is more heart-centered than an infant and being able to open yourself to that love, that unconditional? I mean, an infant comes in loving unconditionally. And when we're able to experience that, which you're saying, you know, society's letting men do more now, then that has to have an impact.
Yes. I mean, I think it's okay for a man now to show his emotions. It's okay to do things that 50 years ago they wouldn't have dreamt of doing and would have refused to do. So I feel there is a coming together there. But why do you think it is that the male has this difficulty with expressing the feminine side? I mean, do you think men and women are balanced, but it's just the way they've been brought up, or is in actual fact a woman more feminine type anyway?
And I think we're talking generalization here, and we both know that, and that's fine, because sometimes, obviously, there will be souls that, in my opinion, you mentioned that too, we incarnate, then our souls may be either fully balanced or aligned to one side or the other, but we may incarnate in either a male or a female throughout our lifetime. So our soul will express the fullness, the truth, and that openness. But biologically, when we choose to incarnate in either a male or a female, I do believe that it supports us in a different way. And so the female who is, you know, the soul who's in a female body and move and creating life, and, you know, the body is programmed for that and for the nurturing and the survival of that young one being brought up, there is going to be an impact on what body that you are in. And then you combine that with the society and the soul to begin with. So there's a lot of factors in that. But we're all trying to find the harmony. So we put ourselves in different situations over different lifetimes so we can experience both sides until we can get that into harmony.
Right. So would you say the divine feminine then is more really to do with our degree of love that we can express?
To me, I speak of the divine feminine sort of in the lineage of Omega. We've got Alpha and Omega, and then together that creates the oneness. And so to me, the divine feminine represents sort of the circular energy, the heart-centered energy, the emotional energy, and the divine masculine, or the Alpha, represents more of a linear energy, the mind, and the thought. So when they're in harmony with each other, think about an individual whose heart and mind are working together, then, you know, that's full power. We can create anything we desire then, because it's going to be perfect. And so, yes, I would say that when I speak of the divine feminine, I'm speaking of the emotional heart-centered side.
Right. So living from the heart is the way to go, and not the mind, because yes?
Actually, I think we want to bring them into harmony. I think that the way the Spirit showed it to me, Magdalene and Isis showed it to me, and that, you know how they say, or people who fly probably know this for true, but that a plane is never actually on course. It's always correcting itself. It goes like in a very fine zigzag pattern. And that's sort of what we've been doing with our mind and our heart. We're either going to lead with our mind or our heart, or when we really start to get in balance, maybe they look like they're kind of together, but one is leading or then the other. But what we really want to do is get to a place where our heart and our mind are actually working together. Because as a society, we're so sided on the male vibration and the thought and the mind for so long, I think we have to spend a little extra time in the heart center right now. But our goal, it isn't that the heart center is better than the mind. It's that we just need to experience it a little bit more so we can bring them back into balance.
Right. Yes. How would one know, say, when they've reached the point of divine love? I mean, is there a point you reach, or is this an ongoing thing that we keep expanding all the time?
I think as long as we're human, we're going to keep expanding. I feel like more and more I live from that place, but I even catch myself every once in a while, and I've dedicated, this whole time to really mastering it. And I think that we have to be really diligent, because if we're human, then that instinct to survive and to compete and to, be in this society is so prevalent that we have to keep being aware of it. I do think that we're reaching a place where that won't be the case, but it is at this point still, I think, an evolution.
Right. Would you say that divine love is the same as unconditional love?
Yes. Well, let's see. Divine love is unconditional.
Right.
So I guess we'll go back the other way. I usually, when I'm using the language, a lot of times, I'm not sure if I intertwine them or not, but to me, like, divine love is the love between us and spirit. Mm. And then unconditional love, I usually use in terms of two humans learning to love in the same divine way, but with the sort of human experience of that.
Right. Now, you've spoken of love, I believe, sacred love, rebuilding our world. I mean, how do you actually visualize that taking place? I mean, what would it entail?
Well, I think it's exactly visualizing. I've been doing a lot of work in the last year of what I see is going into the new vibrant earth, and it's a meditative space that I just, was shown or happened upon while I was working, and it looks very much like this earth, but it's more vibrant, more colorful, colors never seen before, and it's free of it's definitely much more heart-centered and balanced. And what I've been doing and what I've been helping people do is to spend time there in meditation and then see that start to take form in the world around. And it's really beautiful, because the more you spend in that vibration and living from that space, the world around you starts to look like that. And I used to say I live in a really perfect world, and it's the same world you're living in, but it's because of the way I see it. And that is true. And I'm not saying I'm putting blinders on to the fact that the world is evolving and that there's still pain and conflict. But I know that by creating my space in my world and seeing that and holding that reflection here and then rippling that out to others is how we're going to create the world, one person at a time.
Yeah, so are you saying, as I believe, that the more you sort of focus on this new world, the more you're actually helping to create it?
Absolutely, because we're co-creators. And I just... not too long ago, I went to a peace forum, and the Dalai Lama was there and several other world-known, renowned peace activists. And the question came up, and they said, you know, everyone is talking about creating peace, but what happens at world peace, but what happens after that? And it reminded me, my son, when he was younger, said to me, we were talking about video games, and, you know, I said, could we create a video game that didn't have conflict? And he said, Mom, the world wouldn't know what to do without conflict because there would be no plot, and we don't know what to do without a plot. And so putting these two things together, and people at the Peace Forum could not answer. They were so focused on creating peace, they didn't know what it, they had not taken the time to look at what comes after peace. And so I think exactly what you said, if we can start to see a world on the other side of peace, then we actually bring it to us. Because we can't create what we can't imagine.
Indeed, yes. Spirit messages tell us that the cycle that we've just come out of was, in a manner of speaking, totally created by us. It could have been better or worse according to what opportunities we gave the lower vibrations to manifest. So now the energy has, in a manner of speaking, been withdrawn, and we can now apply ourselves to these higher energies. I think there's every opportunity to build this new world that we're dreaming of.
I do too, and I'm really excited about it.
Yes, indeed. Now, how do you think people will benefit from reading your book, The Enchanted One? What will it do for them?
Well, my intention with writing it and the response I'm hearing from people is that it would be layered so that no matter where people are on their journey, they can pick it up. So if somebody is just starting out on the journey of awakening and an opening to it, then they could pick it up and that would take them to the next level. And that people who have been dedicating their lives to this and are just on the verge of being able to live in oneness in every moment of their life and integrate that into their life, that it would help them with that final stage. And so that's what I'm hearing, that people are saying it's very layered. You can read it through once and understand something at one level and then again and again. But that is what I really want people to be able to take from this, is to move them towards literally feeling, embodying, and knowing the oneness and what pure unconditional love really is, and being able to live from that space for themselves.
Right. Now, you talk about the book being a portal to love. What do you mean by the word portal? Does that have any real significance?
You are the second person to ask me that today.
Well, you've got the answer then.
You know, the title of the book came from Magdalene and Isis. First, just Enchanted One. And then the picture of the cover of the book was actually taken by a friend of mine in the monasteries of Italy last year. And as soon as I saw that picture, I actually changed the tagline to The Portal to Love, because it just embodied it for me. So to me, what it is that the book itself is a pathway to help you move into love, and that it opens you and connects you to that pathway, that opening of divine love that is present for us, so that we can actually read. Because again, I didn't write this book just to be a mind-centered task. I want it to be that opening, and I embedded it with the intention that the vibration of love would be there to support it. So I'm seeing that being the portal, the opening that allows us to bring love into our lives.
Do you think this is more possible now than it ever has been in the past?
I absolutely believe that. And, you know, when I was working on the book and trying to get it to the world and thinking it needed to be here 5 years ago, I was so wrong, because the support, it's so tangible. Now, the difference in the energy for people who are even a little bit sensitive, I think it's so tangible. Some people say, oh, nothing happened on the 21st, but so much happened as we moved through that gateway.
Yes, I certainly agree with that. I mean, many sources contributed to the idea that there would be something that people could feel and be aware of. And within my own circle of friends, I have to say, I can't think of any one individual who claimed not to feel anything at all. And in general terms, and this happened to me, I meditated and tried to experience the 21st and the 12th. And I found a beautiful peace and calmness came upon me. And when I finished meditating, that feeling stayed with me. So something certainly did happen.
Absolutely. And I think, I do believe it was happening. It's been happening. You know, I don't think it was just that single day. I think listening through it all year. And so that day became a focal point. But as soon as we, like you said, put the attention, I mean, I think that vibrationally the world was supporting that day in many ways, but then we also put so much intention on that day that that helps us in our group conscience to come together in peace, and that propelled us through too.
Yes. I notice you mentioned group consciousness there. Do you think that happens of its own accord, that the more we become in balance and apply ourselves to being at one, do you think that sort of just grows and happens by itself?
Yes, because we're all one. So, and that's why everything we do for ourselves actually helps the entire world. And it's the best thing we can do for the world is to find, if we can focus our attention on doing what we need to do to find true joy and peace and happiness in our life and love, then that, because we are all connected, there is a group consciousness. It's all, you know, the scientists have proven this. We're all one energy source. So when we shift that, we shift the whole world. And so what we're seeing is, even though we may look at this world right now and say, okay, yes, it's increased and there's more people aware, but it still feels like a handful compared to the entire population of the world. Well, that's irrelevant, because every soul that puts that intention, that knowing into the group consciousness amplifies it. And the people who are coming behind us get it much easier than we do, because we've already created that path.
Yes, that's perfectly true. There seem to be a lot of people that are not awake to what is happening. And maybe we even have friends like that who aren't really interested in anything of a spiritual nature. They couldn't care less whether there's been ascension or that there's a new age starting. Do you think that we can help people like that?
Well, I think that, first of all, I think the energies are getting so intense. It's really fun, and I'm sure you've seen that. It's fun to watch the people who think they don't want to pay any attention to it experiencing it anyway. And then they start coming to us and saying, what's going on? So I think we're going to see more and more of that, because the energies are so strong and they are opening the hearts of people, whether they're doing it intentionally or not. And we're going to see more people who had no interest in it suddenly being able to seek it or ask those questions. I'm also seeing a lot of people who struggled and desired to reach it but never did. All of a sudden, it's just there like a magic wand right now. So all of that is beautiful, but can we help those? I never try to help those who don't want it from me, because right. Go back to the idea that we just spoke about. What I can do to help them the most is embody this. And they start to, and not pay attention of trying to bring them along, because they're a part of the oneness. So if I'm living this, then I'm reflecting it into their life and they're seeing it, they're feeling it, it's going into the group consciousness. They're going to get it one day or another.
Yes, indeed. Do you feel sometimes that people fear to talk about anything that's rings of, say, the name spirit or things of that nature, because they are connecting anything like that, say, with rigid religious beliefs? Do you think they're sort of frightened of what it may entail?
There's definitely been a fear of that in our world, and I think that there's the whole group of people who are resisting. In fact, I had a client today who, you know, said, well, I was raised Catholic, so I resisted spirit because of that. I just wanted to put I didn't agree with the rules there, so I pushed everything away and said I didn't believe in God. The truth is she didn't stop believing in God or staying connected. She just was pushing away some of the man-made structures of that religion. And I think that there's that segment of people who have looked at some of the religious practices in our world that have not really reflected God. And I'm not saying the whole Catholic Church does not reflect God, but I separate spirituality from religion, and I see religion as man-made structure that's based in the rules and the fear. And yeah. I think the group of people that are resisting opening to spirit because they're pushing against that, they don't want the fear and the rules that were placed on them there, so they don't know where to turn from. And then there's the people that are in those organizations and finding some support there and have been – you know, induced into so much fear to step outside of that they're afraid of language. I think language both connects us and divides us, but
yes,
we're doing our best.
I think you're possibly right, yes. And I suspect that since it's the norm for families to perhaps impose or teach their own religious beliefs on their children or send them off to schools or Sunday schools to get religious teachings, that they probably, in a manner of speaking, don't get the right start in life, and that really colours their perception of anything else that's to do with God or spirit, which results in what you said, that some people in the end don't even believe in God.
Right, and I think that's something people are waking up to, and that's one of the things I talk in my book about, not necessarily about the religion, but if we don't stop to think about what we're passing down to our children, if we just pass down what we learned because we learned it, then we will grow as a species, because the next generation is supposed to go beyond us. So before we step forward as parents, we need to review everything that was taught to us and decide for ourselves if that's worth passing on to the next generation.
Indeed, yes. I mean, in general terms, what can people do to increase their awareness of the real truth? How could they approach it when they sort of come to you and want help in that way?
Well, I think that the first thing I tell people is to question everything, and even me. Don't take what I say for granted just because I have a title. Or you need to question everything, and you need to take every bit of information. And when we've taken so much information from a lifetime and not questioned, we need to go back and look at what our behaviors are, what our belief systems are, and find out where they came from and if we really believe them before we move forward. I kind of equate it to the 2-year-olds and the 3-year-olds. I know here we say the trying threes, because they ask so many questions during that time. And we sort of have to go back to that state and start asking questions again, and really not just accepting just because. We have to really look at why.
Yes, indeed. Again, I agree with you there. In your book, since your teachings, if I can call them that, represent what you've learned from Isis and Magdalene, do you differentiate between the sources that you got it from, or is your book a general composition of everything?
This book that just came out, is they do differentiate there, and you can feel the vibrational difference between. So I have sections that are messages from Magdalene, and there are sections messages from Isis, and then in between I weave my own life experience and practical ways of integrating those messages into the daily life. I think in a future book I would just sort of, because we're all becoming more and more one, I would probably just put them all together, but who knows? But right now in this book, yes, it's the three of us that are kind of authoring it.
Right now, I've noticed from your bio that you have children. Do they necessarily inherit your gift of being psychic, shall we say?
I say they do. Well, first of all, they were raised with that being normal. So to them, it just isn't even, it's such a way of life that they don't even think that they are. I mean, it just is, it's so natural to them. My daughter has a radio show. She doesn't on it, but it is about bringing different understandings of spirituality to teens. So she's already moved in that direction. And my son wants to be, and he's only 14, but he wants to be a theoretical physicist. And when he talks about those things, and, you know, I think he kind of thought, well, I'm on the science side, I'm not doing what mom does. But when he starts to talk about the different studies, and I say, well, yeah, I heard about this guy, you know, that happens, and this is how it connects to spirit. He's really reconnecting those two right now, which is really.
Yes, because obviously it doesn't necessarily follow that your children have the same level of understanding. So I guess you never know. I mean, you try and teach them what you consider to be the best way of reaching that point, but you never know, do you really?
You don't. And they're two such different souls, and I try to acknowledge that and raise each of them for the way they are. My daughter is a very old soul. She has been processing past lives since she was a young child.
Really?
And of one of the newer, not new, young souls, but the star children, one of those children, souls that just embodied this understanding of oneness when he was born, but doesn't have past life memories. So I had to raise them both to match what they came in with, too.
Now, we're coming sort of to the end of the program. Is there anything that I haven't touched upon that is in your book that you would like to talk about?
You know what comes to mind right now is forgiveness. And it's kind of a big topic to bring in at the very last minute. But that is.
Well, that's all right. No, there's time, but I haven't got many more questions. So it's really down to you whether you have anything more to add, you see.
Okay, well, Magdalene showed me, forgiveness is a big piece of it, because really to love unconditionally, we have to understand forgiveness. And Magdalene showed it to me that she talks about it as given for us. She loves to do that play on world words, forgiveness given for us. And that we can reach a place in our life where we are so happy and so at peace with where we are, and that we know that everything that ever happened to us brought us to that place. Then we turn around and we can actually feel gratitude for all the events that have occurred. So in her mind, what we're working towards, forgiveness isn't saying, oh, you wronged me and I'm going to be the better person and forgive you and let you, you know, be done with it. Actually, when you reach a place of, you know, okay, I didn't like that experience. I didn't like that behavior. I may not create that in my future life, but look at what it gave me. And I am who I am because of all those experiences. So now I have gratitude for you and for all those experiences. It's a pretty deep level of forgiveness that she speaks about. But I believe people can reach that through the different processes in the book.
Yes. And I would think to achieve that level of understanding, also you've got to reach a point where you can be non-judgmental.
And yes, and that comes again from not feeling threatened by the other person. When we reach a place where our connection to the divine and our trust in that is so strong that the people's behaviors don't threaten us, we're going to be okay no matter what.
Sheila, I'm going to have to ask you to repeat your answer there because your voice was breaking up a bit. Tell us what you said again there.
When we reach that place, that non-judgment comes also from us being in a space of pure love for ourselves and joy, that until we reach that place within ourselves, then we judge others because we perceive them as a threat to our inner peace. And so that's where judgment and non-forgiveness tends to come in, I think.
Yeah, because I think there probably is another aspect to that, that when you understand that we all create our own future, we all have to, if you like, in a manner of speaking, answer for what we do. No one else really has to worry about the consequences of what another person does, because we're all in the same boat, and somewhere down the line we're going to learn from our experiences. And if we need to go through them again because we haven't quite, you know, learned the lessons in them, then we do it again. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And then hopefully we start to break those patterns and life becomes more joyful too.
Yes, absolutely. But a lot of people, I think, find that hard to do. I mean, I have known people around me now who, speaking of judgment, gossip is totally on that subject of what somebody has done or hasn't done and what they should have done instead. And I think, boy, I don't want to know about that. It's difficult, really, when you've got what you might call normal people around you.
I call us normal, but okay.
Yeah, well, I think I'm normal, but when I listen to a lot of other people, I think maybe I'm the odd one out, but never mind. I love myself.
Unusual, maybe, but normal. It should be the new norm.
Well, I mean, all joking apart, if you were to say that to someone, they would think you were egotistical, wouldn't they? They would think, what a big head, or something like that.
It's true, but we need to stop that. We need to be able to claim the beauty of ourselves and see it in others and let them claim it. You know, claiming it in us doesn't mean anyone is less than. We're saying we all are that.
Yeah. Obviously, from the comments you've made, A, you believe in reincarnation. So, secondly, you must believe that when people are put together in relationships, there is a reason for it, even if it appears that the relationship is a dead loss. So, if people come to you that are having a bit of a hard time with their partners, wives, husbands, whatever, would your advice normally be to try and go with it and sort of learn from it and find answers to it?
Well, absolutely. And I do differentiate between loving unconditionally and liking. I think like can be conditional. We can like certain things and we can like certain forms and relationships, and those can change. But and they may need to change in order to love someone more unconditionally. So I am pretty, I don't have a system or another as far as, you know, you should or should not stay in a specific form with a partner that you're in, but you should show up with it and not run away from it and learn to see the truth, learn what you need to learn, learn to return to the place of loving that person unconditionally. And when you reach that place of unconditional love, you may decide that the form needs to change, and then you do that in a loving way.
Yes, and I suspect if you can do that, where you're in a pretty hard relationship, reach a point of unconditional love, probably even then your partner recognizes that within you and learns something themselves from it.
Right, and relationships don't have to end. That's our old paradigm of thinking. You're in it or you're not in it. They just can change forms. My ex-husband and I are very good friends. We have, you know, we're like brother and sister now, because that really, once we did the work and brought the children into the world, that's more of what our vibration was. And we've co-parented together. We're close friends. Yeah. But we weren't meant to stay in that form of relationship.
No. I feel myself, and this is purely my personal belief, that since we were in the end times of the last cycle, which is generally known as the cycle of duality, I think in our, what you might call our last lives in that low vibration, we've had taken on a lot of hard work where relationships are concerned, because it surprises me when you get to know people a bit better how many of them have had trouble with relationships. I find it astounding.
I think you're absolutely right about that, that we did try to kind of, you know, we all cram for our exams, and we tried to put into these last lifetimes a lot of our mastery of those lessons. One of the things I've also noticed in the last week, we entered into 2000, it's been a busy week, is relationship people change, needing people in relationships that weren't having or weren't discussing issues as much, needing to make adjustments. But what I'm really seeing in the last week or so is people coming to me and saying, we love each other very much. We're both clear on that, but the form's not working for us anymore, and we don't know what to do. So I think we're actually moving into a place where the old form is becoming the conflict, because our old form of marriage is based on survival and therefore conditional love. I'm not saying you can't have unconditional love in a marriage, but the form itself is actually supporting conditional love, and so we need to adjust it to match now.
That's true, yes. I mean, everything connected with it. If you have a church ceremony, the wording of it and other things are all based on conditions, aren't they?
Absolutely. It's a contract. And really, yes. It's a contract. That's a whole
right.
other
So maybe many years ago, when the younger generations started to talk about free love and probably living together without marriage, perhaps that wasn't such a bad idea in some ways.
They set the stage. I think they had a seed, but they didn't know what to do with it. And now we're actually bringing into some truth some of those ideas that came out during
yes. the time. Yes, I think so. What did they say? Love, not war.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there was some beautiful things that came out during that time. But it
there
just
was, yeah.
kind of infused with a lot of drugs and confusion. But now we can do
oh,
this
well.
The way.
There is a downside as well. Yes, you're right. More freedom. Well, then some people don't know how to use it the right way. Now, I haven't given you an opportunity yet to give our listeners your website address or tell them where your book's available from. Would you like to go ahead and tell them?
Sure. My website is SheilaAppelgate.com, SheilaAppelgate.com. And the books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble online, and Sacred Spaces is the other website that they're on. They're actually going to be linking up to my website soon. And they're in bookstores, you know, wherever they have been or can be ordered into bookstores as well. I'm not sure which bookstores out there are holding them right now and which aren't, but those are places that everyone can get them.
Okay. Now, do I correctly understand that you have a video trailer that relates to your book?
I do. it is on my website, and it is also right now on Red Wheel and Weiser's front page of their website. That's my publishing company. It's on YouTube. You could look it up there.
Okay. I think that possibly covers it, in which case I have to thank you very, very much for coming onto the program. It's been enjoyable talking to you, and I think clearly what you're doing is precisely the right thing for the time we're in, and I hope your book's a great success.
Thank you very much. It's been wonderful to be on here, and I have such an affinity to England that it's just wonderful even to hear your accent, so thank you.
what do you mean? I have us no. English, we don't have accents.
Of course, not English people, but
yeah, I love that when some of my American friends say, I love your accent. Oh, it's hard to understand that. We all speak like that over here. Well, that's not true, of course, but there you are. Well, thank you very much, Sheila. As I said, it's been very nice speaking with you, and every success to you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
Thank you. Well, friends, that was a nice lady, and she certainly knows what she's talking about. I'm sure a book will be a success. Now, next week, I have a lady called Ruth Ann Mack, spelled M-A-K. She works with mind, body, and spirit, and her goal is to bring about peace and joy. So that's a very limited description of what she does. She also is actually a Reiki master, shamanic practitioner, and a teacher, and a Lahochi facilitator. So she's got a pretty interesting background to her. So thank you for being with me today. I do hope you can make it next week. If it's not too late, Happy New Year to you all. And I hope you'll be with me next week. So God bless you all. Thank you very much.